exhibition going on at the moment in London at the Tate Britain. He's obviously, Deleuze is very popular in the art world generally, but in the contemporary art world, people are not so interested in the aesthetic work of Deleuze, they're more interested in the political work. So it's in relationship to Bacon that he's been taken up, I think, in the most serious way by people outside of philosophy. It's very interesting that Deleuze writes about Bacon, which is not exactly the most fashionable thing to write about. I've sort of alluded to this a little bit. I don't know if we'll ever really get to talk about it properly. Maybe there'll be time today. But, you know, Deleuze and Guattari reject conceptual art. This is more or less to reject most art after 1968 or so. And Deleuze writes a book about a painter, Francis Bacon, and really affirms painting all the way through, right up to the end, as the kind of privileged art form. So in my way of thinking, this doesn't really make Deleuze particularly, let's say, in tune with contemporary art practice, despite the fact that contemporary art practice is, let's say, very much in tune with Deleuze, in as much as so much contemporary art writing and contemporary artists want to use Deleuze, or at least mention Deleuze, and mention some kind of concepts which come from Deleuze. But as I said before, this kind of use of Deleuze by contemporary art tends to avoid the aesthetic concept. So in other words, it doesn't tend to draw on the Bacon book, and it doesn't tend to draw on the use that Deleuze makes of art history. For example, contemporary art wants to take, as I said before, the kind of more political ideas from Deleuze, which perhaps reflects contemporary art's strong interest in some kind of political validity these days. But to me, it asks a very big question. You know, the question is, well, if we are to use Deleuze to try and understand contemporary art, and why not, then somehow you have to get around this fact that for Deleuze, you know, art after conceptual art is not really art, and for him, real art is painting, which is not exactly real art by contemporary art standards. So this provides something of a problem, I think, which nobody has really seriously addressed, because everybody is just so enthusiastic about, let's say, entering into the marketplace of ideas with the latest commodity, which is, at the moment, although probably not for much longer, Deleuze. So we're already seeing within the art world anyway a kind of move towards something beyond Deleuze, the new theoretical commodity. And this is not a reflection of the end of Deleuze's usefulness or interest, it's just a reflection of the fact that the art world is structured like a market, and it simply requires new commodities. So you can't keep selling the same shit for too long because everyone gets sick of it. So at the moment, Deleuze has been very, very hot commodity for about 10 years, and so now it's time to change it. So wait and see what comes. One of the people I'm going to talk about in January, Rancière, has been championed as the new philosopher about art, but it remains to be seen whether this is going to carry on or not. All right. Has everyone got a handout? Right, okay. In the book, I'm just putting the book around. If everyone just has a look at it, I'm going to talk about Francis Bacon today. So if you don't know the paintings, have a look at the catalogue just to get some idea. So last week I talked about, mainly about Wilhelm Waringer, but in a more general sense about the way that Deleuze-Guattari draw upon this expressionist tradition of German art history to explore a transcendental conception of aesthetic production that was organised around these poles We remember abstraction and empathy. Today, I'm going to develop Deleuze's concept of art history in relation to its major example in Deleuze's work, which is the book he wrote about Francis Bacon, the English painter Francis Bacon, called Francis Bacon, The Logic of Sensation. It's an interesting title, The Logic of Sensation, given that Deleuze hated logic. Well, maybe hated logic is a bit too strong, but let's say he didn't like logic. And he actually called two books, you know, he used logic. So there's The Logic of Sense, and it's written in 1968-69. And then there is this Logic of Sensation, which is published, if I remember rightly, about 1984. So we might think, what has logic got to do with sensation, given that Deleuze rejects logic pretty categorically? And in a way, I think we can understand it as being an irony, because what he's talking about with the logic of sensation is not a logic in the way that we might think of logic in terms of analytical philosophy. The logic is simply used in a much more kind of banal or everyday sense, as meaning the kind of the structure or the kind of, let's say the structure of sensation, the way that sensation is constructed, first of all by Francis Bacon. All right, Deleuze writes, this is the first quotation on the sheet, very important one. We do not listen enough to what painters have to say. It was written in 19... As I said, I might be wrong about this, but I think it's written in 1984. It's the French publication date for the Francis Bacon book, 1984. So we have to remember, 1984, we're in the kind of midst of postmodernism. Yeah, we're in the midst of this movement which celebrates quotation and denies originality and, let's say, artistic intention. It's a time where the ideas, for example, of Roland Barthes celebrated, most especially, an essay that was actually first published in English in 1967 in a conceptual art magazine called Avalanche, and that is his essay, Death of the Author. This essay, Death of the Author, basically argues that any process of reading a text is a process of, let's say, reconstituting the text from the point of view of the reader. So in other words, the intention of the author is not the thing that generates meaning, but the act of reading. And this is going to be a dominant motif for most of the 80s, and especially within painting, where you're going to have this style known as quotationism, artists are going to just simply quote other images and collage them together within the painting. So, for Deleuze to write in 1984, we do not listen enough to what painters have to say. It's not only a kind of a provocation, but it's also, if you like, perhaps a response to this kind of postmodernism that was dominant at the time. But when he says we do not listen enough to what painters have to say, he's also talking about philosophers. We, Deleuze as a philosopher, we also perhaps as philosophers, who have only rarely listened to artists, let alone seriously considered their work. In fact, Deleuze's book on Bacon is reasonably unusual for an artist to write an entire... for a philosopher to write an entire book about painting. In my experience, artists know a great deal more about philosophy than philosophers do about art. In fact, I'll never forget, I shouldn't say it, it's a bit naughty of me to name names, but I'll never forget a dinner once where I was with my the supervisor of my PhD. His name is Paul Patton, who's a very well-known Deleuzian in the English world. He's translated Difference and Repetition and various other things. And I'll never forget him saying, "Oh, you know, that guy who did the artwork that was a toilet." All right, okay. He didn't know so much about art. Let's just say that. He knew a lot about philosophy. That's true. Okay, so in his book on Bacon, Deleuze seeks to rectify this problem of philosophers not listening enough to what painters have to say, by giving not only Bacon's paintings, but also Bacon's words, as much philosophical weight as that given to any of the individual philosophers he has written about. In actual fact, Deleuze is going to, the main source for the book on Bacon is actually a collection of interviews that were made by David Sylvester with Francis Bacon and published as a volume. And an enormous amount of what Deleuze is saying in the book on Bacon is actually a paraphrasing of what Bacon already said about his own work in these interviews. So when Deleuze says we don't listen enough to what painters have to say, Deleuze is really trying to put this into action, if you like, in his book on Bacon. Not only because he treats it so seriously, but because it really is composed from Bacon's own words. Bacon's logic of sensation is, for Deleuze, a kind of thought. For Deleuze, a logic of sensation could be a form of thought because it rests upon a shared genesis, that is, both sensation and thought share their origin in an encounter of forces. Deleuze writes in Difference and Repetition, "On the path which leads to that which is to be thought, all begins with sensibility." So again, this sort of echoes the lecture that we had about Deleuze and phenomenology. Yeah, this kind of ambiguous relation or ambivalent relation, because for Deleuze, everything begins with sensibility, everything begins with sense, yeah, with sensation, in fact. That even thought has to be based upon some kind of an encounter, some kind of a force, that thought encounters or that stimulates thought. This double origin, let's say, of thought and of art in sensation arises because the force that we encounter and the sensation that we have are, for Deleuze, the same thing. So this is the genesis not only of a sensation but also of a thought. But this is everything begins with this feeling, with this sensation, with this encounter. Yeah? And that everything that we think, just as everything that we write or everything that we put into a work of art, emerges from this sensation. So sensibility is prior to everything else. It's prior to thought for Deleuze. This is not exactly a phenomenology, but it's, let's say, it's a consequence of the privileging of the body in Deleuze's philosophy. Yeah? That we think through the body, we don't think with the mind. And the mind is a kind of ideal, abstract category that Deleuze actually doesn't like very much. We think through the body, and a great deal of that process is a process of feeling for Deleuze. It's a kind of phenomenology, but without all of the problems that we saw with transcendental subjectivity and so forth and so on, that we saw Deleuze having problems with previously. Deleuze addresses the ontological, art historical, and painterly aspects of Bacon's logic of sensation through the concept of the diagram. The diagram is what's also known in A Thousand Plateaus as an abstract machine that is specific to Bacon and which operates to compose matter and force into a painting. We have, remember from last week, I talked a little bit about these flows of matter and force that the metallurgist composes into artifacts, or artifacts of a material, cultural artifacts. And an artist acts in a very similar way. The artist, or the artist's diagram, is a kind of a machine which enters into the flows of matter and force and composes these flows into individual objects that express something of the movement and force that the artist finds there, or that the diagrams find there. So with the diagram, we are immediately within the Deleuzian double dimension of aesthetics. This is, we remember from Watteau's philosophy, art creates the finite in order to restore the infinite. That's something that Deleuze and Guattari say in Watteau's philosophy. Art creates the finite that restores the infinite. This is the double dimension of art. It's both finite and infinite. It has to enfold these two elements within it. This is what we've also talked about as being the actual and the virtual. So the diagram creates a finite work that simultaneously restores to it an infinite ontological dimension. This restoration will begin with a destruction, one in which, as Deleuze dramatically puts it, it is as if the two halves of the head were split open by an ocean. That's what he says. So two halves of the head are split open by an ocean, or perhaps by a desert. These are two motifs that come from Bacon's painting, the ocean and the desert, but they're also two metaphors, if you like, for infinity. So the finite mind, human mind, is going to be split open by these sensations that Bacon's work, Bacon's diagram is going to compose, and it's going to restore to these finite objects, these paintings, the infinite. So Bacon's paintings, but it's true for all painting, is going to begin with a fundamental violence, a splitting open that allows for, Deleuze says, the emergence of another world. This violent catastrophe erupts within the canvas as chaotic splurts of paint and random rubbings of the canvas. This is the first step in Bacon's process of composing a painting. He kind of throws paint at it. This is, he calls it an accident. He just throws paint at it without any kind of idea in his mind. And then he sort of rubs it, rubs the paint, rubs the canvas, various different tools, but in a kind of random way. And this is going to have various functions, but it's going to provide the basis for the process of composing into a sensation. It's going to introduce a chaos onto the painting, onto the canvas. And this is very important, because what this is going to achieve is it's going to get rid of all the clichés that Bacon says already occupy the empty canvas before an artist even starts. He says, and Deleuze agrees with him, that this is the basic problem that the painter's faced with when they start painting, that their own head and the canvas is already full, completely packed with clichés and with banal ideas, with received knowledges, with the history of art, with the history of philosophy, with what happened yesterday, with my thoughts about, you know, what's happening in my relationship and so forth and so on. Completely banal clichés. Yeah? It's everywhere. And the real problem for a painter is how to avoid painting clichés. How to actually achieve, of course we know, this is Deleuze's great underlying problem, how can we create something that is new? Something that is new. Because what is new is something that is alive. Because life is always in the process of producing something new. So how can the artist embody this inorganic life? How can the artist express this kind of life, this living energy. Yeah? And the first thing they have to do if they want to do that is they have to destroy. They have to, you know, destroy this language of cliché, this kind of constant circulation of cliché. So this is why there needs to be, as the first step of the diagram, there needs to be this catastrophe, this introduction of chaos into the canvas. Yeah? Deleuze writes, "The diagram is indeed a chaos, a catastrophe, but it is also a germ of order or rhythm." So it's precisely this chaos which is going to give the beginning. It's going to destroy and clear the canvas of cliché, but it's also going to provide the first, let's say, notes or the first rhythms that from which the painting is going to emerge. So this catastrophe both destroys what has gone before, the cliché, and it provides the seed for whatever it is that's going to emerge instead of these clichés. So it is very much in the spirit of Nietzsche, no creation without destruction. This is a constant theme of Nietzsche. So you can't create anything without destroying what it is that prevents you from creating. Yeah? You can't just say, right, okay, good, now I'm going to make something new. This doesn't just happen like that, because there are many, many things that are preventing you from doing this. And part of the process of creation is to understand and to see what it is that prevents us from doing something new, so that we can destroy those things in order to create something new. This is true for philosophy, this is true for art, this is true for our own personal lives. Yeah, this is a general thing. So, the chaos is a catastrophe, but it is also, let's say, the germ, as Deleuze calls it, it's an interesting term, the germ of order or rhythm. Yeah, it's certainly germ in the sense of something that is not normal. It is this great health that Nietzsche often talks about, a kind of health which to the rest of society seems like a sickness. But that's its health, because it steps outside of society, it steps outside of what is normal. So it's a germ of order or rhythm. So Bacon's diagram begins from this accident, this throwing of paint on the canvas and the random rubbing and marks that he begins with. And then it develops according to a logic that is going to encompass all aspects of the compositional process, but is going to focus, at least for Deleuze, on the use of colour. Colour is going to be the major, let's say, it sounds funny, but anyway, the major philosophical value inside Bacon's paintings. Yeah, we'll see why that is as we go along. Now, before I get to the more specific details about Bacon's process, I just, first of all, want to return to this idea of art history, because with the diagram, we have the idea of a diagrammatic art history in which we can trace differences and similarities between artists' diagrams rather than simply rehearse their biographies or list the artists' names. Deleuze is not interested in writing a Lives of the Artists, which is, of course, the name of the very famous art history book from the Renaissance by Vasari. It's not about understanding the biographies of the artist in order to understand the artwork. The diagrammatic art history is about understanding the diagrams, and the diagrams which have marked the history of painting and the history of art, and the relationship between these diagrams. Deleuze writes, not only can we differentiate amongst diagrams, but we can also date the diagram of the painter. This date refers to the appearance of a diagram or abstract machine. In A Thousand Plateaus, Each plateau carries such a date. For example, on November 28, 1947, Antonin Artaud announces The Body Without Organs in a radio broadcast of his poem To Be Done with the Judgment of God. So the plateau, which is how do we make ourselves a body without organs, this is dated November 28, 1947. This is the date at which this diagram, the diagram of the body without organs, emerges. So Deleuze perhaps has a similar idea about art history. Now, dating the diagram does give it a historical specificity, but this historical specificity is perhaps misleading. The diagram is neither determined by a historical event, nor is it simply reducible to a historical event. So in other words, okay, there is this date for the body without organs, but the body without organs as a diagram is not, let's say, necessarily connected to this date. In other words, it's not that the body without organs cannot exist before that date or after that date, and neither is it that the body without organs is, let's say, some kind of historical entity or event. It's not. It's just a convenient way of naming it. The diagram operates a fold between chaos and history, by which the actual gains a new power of expression beyond any historical determination by diving into chaos in order to construct a new virtual plane of composition. In other words, the diagram is not determined by historical events. The diagram is actually the moment where we leave history and something happens that is no longer determined by history, something new. Deleuze and Guattari say, how can something new come from history? How can it? History is just the conditions by which that we leave in order for something new to actually happen. So this is the process that Guattari will call chaosmosis. Each diagram confronts chaos, dives into chaos, but only in order to create what Deleuze and Guattari call a new type of reality. As a result, Deleuze and Guattari write, the diagram does not stand outside history, but is instead always prior to history. This priority is ontological rather than temporal, and like the priority of sensation to thought, the diagram acts as history's imminent condition and does not exist apart from the history that actualizes it. That's why it can be dated. But the diagram, and especially its destructive encounter with chaos, is not part of history. It is precisely the way art leaves history in order to reinvent itself as something new. So this is what Deleuze and Guattari are going to call the event. There has to be an event. The event is a moment of creation. This is a moment by which an artist is able to destroy, let's say, their historical conditions, all of the cliches and the accepted meanings that history has given, that the artist is able to summon enough, let's say, violence is very important in Deleuze's discussion of Bacon, to summon enough violence to break with this history. So they can break with the history, they can leave history and enter into chaos beyond space and time. And they can bring back from this encounter something which is new, something which has not previously existed. Now, that thing which has not previously existed does not come from history. It comes from leaving history. But when it does become actual and in the world, then it enters into history and becomes part of history. So history is this constant, let's say, departure, destruction, in order for it to be recreated or something new to be added to it. So there is this constant kind of, we could almost call it a dialectic, a kind of a deterritorialization and a re-territorialization, a kind of a leaving and arriving, a kind of historical break that reconstitutes history itself. Yeah, this kind of rhythmical passage. So, the diagram is the way that art leaves history in order to reinvent itself as something new. And so it's this idea of producing something new, which is very much at the centre, not just of Deleuze's ideas about art, but Deleuze's ideas about philosophy, and in fact Deleuze's ideas about life. That this is what is living. To live is precisely to destroy what has been before in order to create something new. This is the Nietzschean concept of, not just of history, but also of life, of will to power, this constant force of overcoming. So this brings up the question I'm not really going to try and answer today, but certainly it's another very important question when thinking about Deleuze and art, is what is then the relationship between Deleuze and the tradition of the avant-garde? Because this emphasis on the new is very much, let's say, part of some aspects of the avant-garde tradition. Again, precisely a tradition that with postmodernism we had imagined we had gone beyond. So, okay, it's no secret, Deleuze and especially Guattari, they hate postmodernism. They think it's one of the worst things that ever happened. So it's no surprising that they rather perversely affirm such things as modernism, avant-garde tradition, painting, colour and so forth, that seem to be, that we all thought that we had somehow got beyond. So anyway, finally, Deleuze and Guattari write, history today still designates only the set of conditions, however recent they may be, from which one turns away in order to become, that is to say, in order to create something new. So we have to leave history if we are to, if you like, make history. As long as we stay within the boundaries of what has already happened, what has already been thought, and so forth, we're never going to make something new.
In Buddhist philosophy, Thérèse and Couture writes that it's not the task to destroy everything and build up new terms, but to connotate the terms that are existing, mm-hmm. like give them new colors, if you want it like that. Mm-hmm. So my question is it really that necessary to destroy something? Is this crisis thing the only thing that's really possible? This crisis of destroying and building something new, isn't there another way to build up new things?
Maybe. You have to try. I say destruction for, let's say, dramatic effect, yeah. It's the kind of Nietzschean drum that bangs behind Deleuze and Guattari, if you want to hear it. You could also understand what they do, maybe not in such dramatic terms as destruction, but we can understand it in terms of what I've talked about before, ventriloquism, which is, let's say, maybe a gentler metaphor, yeah? So he's making other philosophers say something new, but it's not anything they didn't already say themselves. Okay. But I think the idea remains unchanged, yeah? That even if you use the same words, you are reconfiguring them in a way which allows them to leave their inherited meanings.
But it's not destruction. You don't. You need to destroy the world when you want to build the world.
Well, it depends on your definition of destruction. I mean, there are many different ways, I think, to destroy something. I mean, what would you call Deleuze's relationship to Hegel? In a very literal sense, he never destroys Hegel because he never even talks about Hegel. Yeah, but Hegel is completely absent from his account of the history of philosophy. So is that a destruction or not a destruction? Well, we're just arguing about the meaning of terms here, but the point is that, you know, basically, all right, we can step back, one step back from destruction and let's say radical reconfiguration, yeah? Something like that. I don't know. I mean, the term becoming, it's central to Deleuze's philosophy. But the term of becoming has a very long history. Yeah, that's been used by many, many, many philosophers, not least of whom is Hegel. Yeah, but nevertheless, Yeah, there is a very important part of that tradition which is lost in Deleuze and Guattari's definition of becoming. Now, whether we call that a destruction or not a destruction, it's not really the point. The point is that you have to, in order to create something new, you have to disconnect it from, let's say, its inherited tradition. In other words, we can't use the term becoming in the way that Hegel used it if we want to create a new kind of philosophy, a new kind of understanding of becoming.
Especially Hegel made it very, very wisely when he talked about this aufheben, you know, aufgehoben. I don't know what's the
yes, English expression. Sublation.
It's on one hand is negated, and on the other hand conservated in one word, and in one move. And this is not destroying, not just destroying.
Well, this is what Deleuze completely rejects. So this is a concept of difference that's based on negation, and this is not Deleuze's concept of difference at all, and that's the reason why he is strongly opposed to Hegel, because Hegel wants to understand difference through the process of negation, and Deleuze wants to understand it through the process of affirmation, to affirm difference in itself. Because for Hegel, you can never understand difference without understanding what it is different from. Yeah? It's always a relation of negation which defines difference. But Deleuze wants to explore a concept of difference which is affirmative, which is positive, and which can grasp difference in itself. Now, in difference repetition, the concept is going to be eternal return. So in other words, it's going to be Nietzsche.
So for Deleuze, as well as for Nietzsche, positivation or affirmation is not the same thing as double negation.
No, not at all, not at all. And affirmation is not going to preserve anything. Yeah? Affirmation of difference is going to create something new. Yeah? So it's not going to preserve what it's left behind. It's not this. It's not the spiral. It's not the dialectical spiral. So to affirm a difference in itself is to affirm a real break. Yeah? It's not to preserve what it is against. It is to say, this thing in itself is difference, and this is new. But the question is, how can we do that? Yeah? And that's what I'm trying to describe when I use the term destruction, but maybe you're right to say that it's too strong.
What about the term transformation?
Yeah, transformation, it's not a term that Deleuze uses a great deal, but yeah, okay, that's another possibility.
But the problem is, inside transformation, there's also a residuum of something.
To transform something else. Well, I don't think that that's, again, I don't think that's, obviously, it would be unrealistic to say that everything just emerges out of nothing. It's not, I mean, they say here, history provides the conditions under which it becomes possible for us to leave history.
But this might be a more soft term.
So, it's not that history is lost. It's that history provides us the conditions under which we are able to create something new. So, we can't just create something new out of nothing. Yeah, there's the great German phrase, nothing from nothing. Nothing comes from nothing. I mean, it's not possible. So, history provides the conditions under which it becomes possible to leave history, to enter chaos and bring something new back from it. Yeah, that's the basic idea of the diagram. Alright. The diagram is a way to understand art history as the emergence of new artistic realities in a series of events, moments when artists free themselves from their historical artistic conditions in order to invent something new. Furthermore, the ontology of painting diagrams as abstract machines, create sensations that put us, to use a phrase of Deleuze and Guattari, flush with the real. It puts us within the process of creation. It puts us in a position where we experience and participate in the ongoing chaosmosis that sustains a painting's vitality and ongoing becoming. So this is very important. This is one of the major themes of the Bacon book, is that when a painter, in this case Bacon, paints a sensation, creates a sensation by definition is not something that just exists on the canvas. The sensation is something which encompasses the viewer and the painter. Is it, why is that? Well, if we think back to the quotation from Difference and Repetition that said that sensibility is the origin of all thoughts and all sensations, that it is an encounter with a force which is at the origin of any thought or any production, then we understand that a sensation is produced. It is produced by the painter in the painting. But that painting never actually exists except in as much as someone sees it. So it's only insofar as somebody experiences this painting that the sensation can exist as such. It's only in this encounter, in this experience of the force that the painting captures, that a sensation can in fact live. So it's only going to happen through the experience that someone has of it. It's only going to exist within sensibility, within somebody's experience. This is very important. It's going to take a special kind of vision that is going to be able to see this. This merge of viewer and painting within the diagram is going to require a new form of vision, what Deleuze will here call a haptic eye. This is another term that comes from Alois Regel, the Viennese art historian, who discussed the category of haptic a great deal. Haptic basically means there is a kind of a physical connection that is made through sight. Yeah? Sight becomes a kind of feeling. Yeah?
Sorry, what about people who cannot see?
That's a very good question. There is a kind of hapticity which applies to hearing. Yeah. So if you read the Bacon book, you see that, strangely enough, one of the most common other artists that is discussed in the book is Olivier Messiaen, a composer. Yeah? And Deleuze seems to be very interested in the connection between the paintings and between Messiaen's form of compositions. He talks about a chronochromy. Yeah? No, which is a kind of a mixture between time and colour. So there is a certain point at which the senses, let's say, merge at a certain level of abstraction. So a person who cannot see is not denied sensation because there are other senses that they can have a sensation through, and they're not denied art because they can experience music. But it's true that in relationship to visual art, obviously blind people don't have access to that. But that's not really a philosophical point, that's like a physiological point. Yeah.
But it could also be a philosophical point, because if you're stressed on vision, really vision, then somebody is excluded. I mean, I think it is.
It's true, it's definitely. Vision is the privileged sense, there is no doubt about that. That's definitely a way in which Deleuze is, let's say, maybe a part or an inheritor from the phenomenological tradition. It's definitely something which it's not just Deleuze who does this, but it's part of a long line of thinking about art, that yes, sight is privileged, there's no doubt about it, vision. But at the same time, I've already talked about this a little bit before, vision has this aspect for Deleuze of visionary, which is like hallucination, yeah? Which is like seeing beyond the actual world into the virtual world. And this element of vision, I think, is not specifically tied to optical vision. That this kind of vision could also be possible for a composer, for someone who listens to music, yeah, that it might also be possible for someone without sight to have a kind of a vision of something new, let's say.
May I give an example?
Yeah, first here.
Wasn't Messiaen a synesthetic person? I'm not quite sure if he discusses it in the book, but...
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure whether Messiaen was interested in synesthesia. It's quite possible.
I think he was. I think he said he heard the tones of... When he heard the tones, he saw some colours. So.
Certainly, it would be no surprise to find some level of synesthesia in Deleuze and Guattari. Synesthesia is a classic, important element of romantic aesthetic theory, and Deleuze and Guattari clearly influenced by romanticism in a lot of what they write about art, so it wouldn't surprise me. Yes?
I once was confronted with a man who is actually blind, and he is a photographer at the same time. I forgot his name, I think Bosch or something like this. And it was a photography class, and we were asked to actually show him pictures. So I thought first it's completely grotesque to show him photographs because he can't see it. So what I did, I showed him some images that were especially dealing with colors. So, and we were talking about these photographs, and actually he forced me somehow to look at these photographs in a completely different way, so I could draw something out of it, which was completely new. So even though he never saw something, he had a certain kind of vision, which is more a mental vision.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what Deleuze maybe means,
mm-hmm.
because he says you have to put every faculty to its extreme.
Yes, you have to reach the point where the faculties are overcome, but he's not talking about the senses as faculties in that regard. He's talking about imagination, understanding, so forth and so on.
There's a very special phenomenon about blind or seeing. It's called blind sight, maybe you know. It's if you have some lesions in the brain and lesions in visual areas, and you cannot see with consciousness, but you can somehow react visual inputs. You can, for example, there are some experiments with people who have this special ability of blindsight. So they were asked, for example, to point at the thing in the room, and they cannot see it, but if they are forced to decide where the thing is, they can decide and with, I don't know how to tell it in English, but with more than 50%, they can detect the right position of the thing.
Mm, interesting.
I don't know if you understand.
Mm, interesting. All right. But this is a good point and an interesting one. It is definitely something that people have criticized Deleuze and Guattari for, this emphasis on vision or on the visual optical capacity. And it's certainly true about the book on Bacon, that there is everything is around the eye, the haptic eye, the optical vision, and so forth and so on. I'll talk more about it today. So the artistic diagram is both visionary in constructing a new form of art from chaos and is expressed in a vision, the haptic vision of the artwork that renders it visible and that extends its creative energy infinitely into each of the encounters that plunges the painting back into the chaosmosis from which it has come. This is the other element of the fact that if a sensation only exists in its experience by someone who is looking at the picture, yeah, then every time someone looks at the picture, there is, let's say, the sensation lives on, the sensation continues to live, because each time that happens, there is the opportunity for it to become something else, for the sensation to emerge again. Yeah. And that's a kind of a very fancy way of saying a very banal observation, which is that people are affected very differently by different pictures. In this way, the diagram creates new reality out of heterogeneous realities, not just for the time to come, but also for the time that has been, for the history which has supposedly led up to it. I'm talking now about the art historical diagram. It is in this sense that Bacon's diagram recapitulates the history of painting in his own way. This is the title of one of the chapters in the Bacon book, Every Painter Recapitulates the History of Painting. So it means every painter remakes the history of painting for themselves. Bacon's diagram creates a new reality for painting, and in doing so revitalizes art history by constructing a new genealogy, one beginning with the Egyptians and encompassing a series of stopping points in Byzantine, Venetian, Gothic, and modern art. This creative art history is like Deleuze's history of philosophy, which similarly discovers a discovery inseparable from an invention, a materialist vitalist tradition opposed to the representational image of thought. The point is that both Deleuze and Bacon undertake an ontological reinvention of history rather than a historical revisionism, and both move through a series of stopping places that they compose into a new diagram and that in turn creates a new reality. This is finally the meaning of what they call the heterochronic diagram. While it composes its own tradition, this tradition is itself composed of creative breaks, making the heterochronic tradition a fractal rather than linear history, each one of its breaks reinventing the others and making them creative once more. So Bacon composes his own diagram out of various other aspects in art history, various other elements in art history. I'll talk about some of them today. The Egyptian, for example, the Gothic, the various elements of the modern diagram, most importantly Cézanne, post-impressionism. But each of these elements is itself a break which has constituted the tradition. So in using these elements and putting them into combination with other elements, Bacon in effect reinvents the history of painting, but for himself, yeah? Which is very similar to what Deleuze does with philosophy. So Deleuze takes these various figures from philosophy, composes them into a tradition, the history of so-called materialist vitalism, and this culminates with him.
So do you have to know history to create something new?
Yeah, I think that's definitely implied. Yep. I don't. You can't just like create something new out of nothing. It's. I mean, they talk a bit, quite a bit, in fact, about the artistic productions of children, mad people, and drug users. Yeah? Because these would be maybe the three realms in which you could say, well, they can produce an artwork without really knowing what the hell's going on. Yeah? And in the end, they say, after a lot of kind of to-ing and fro-ing, that actually, well, yes, it's very nice. Yes, sometimes it can be approaching an artwork, but in the end, it doesn't have, and this is actually what they say, it doesn't have the required solidity. They say it's too flaky, that the artworks of mad people, children, and drug users. That it doesn't have this kind of basis which is really able to project itself as something new. Yeah? So that's a long way of saying, yeah, you have to know history. I mean, it's just like thinking, how would it be possible for someone to think up a new philosophy without knowing the history of philosophy? It's very hard to imagine what that would really be.
It's like painting elephants.
Painting elephants.
You know, this kind of art where animals are given pencils and things, and they start to paint, and it's the very grotesque and obscure end of this whole express yourself thing. Elephants able to paint too.
It's difficult to say, because at the same time, obviously, Deleuze and Guattari affirm, you know, the kind of, they're very interested in mental illness, let's put it that way, as a productive, interesting, valuable way of being. Yeah? Just as they're interested in becoming child. Yeah? That's an important kind of phase of becoming, that we have to try and become child. It gives us a freedom, a kind of a joyfulness, yeah, that we don't have in adult life. And at the same time, they also want to affirm drug use, because they say it gives us a molecular perception. It gives us a perception of the world which kind of escapes, you know, the normal ways of seeing and doing. So it's not to say that they reject those things. It's just that they reject those things as ways of creating art. It's not to say they're not valuable or they don't have a role to play. It just means that this is not really art that's being produced here. Now, it's quite problematic in a way, especially I mean, obviously there's a whole interest in art by mad people. I mean, outsider art is like a whole genre of art, which is basically recognized as art. And similarly speaking, the history of intoxicated artists is extremely long. So what we're really to make of these things in a real kind of real way, I don't know, but let's just say at an abstract level, they're going to reject those things as being ways to make art.
Yeah, it's very difficult, I think, because in Austria we had this example with cooking, you probably know, where there was an insane asylum and people started to paint, and it was considered as art in the art market. That's one example, and the other one is surrealism itself. Because if you read the manifesto from Breton, it's very much about getting rid of everything and drawing on this potential of nothing. And the question is, if this pieces of artwork that have been constructed out of nothing on the market, they again can also produce something new. What's there?
So well, the question is, what is it expressing?
It's completely is a different one.
It's not. I mean, yeah. Anyway, I don't really want to get into the intricacies of this. It's an interesting essay topic if someone wants to follow it up. All right. So, in actual fact, Deleuze's reading of Bacon's recapitulation of art history is itself a kind of reinvention, because I think I mentioned this before, Deleuze doesn't talk about, or hardly mentions, Picasso and Velázquez, who are very important for Bacon in actual fact, and he doesn't mention Ingres at all, and Ingres is, I mean, you just can look in there and you see the way that Bacon drew upon Ingres' painting. So Deleuze is not doing this diagrammatic art history. It's not really an art history in the traditional sense of the word, because it's selective. Yeah? Deleuze is selecting certain influences and certain aspects that compose this diagram, and he's not trying to do art history. An art historian is going to tell you all of the influences of Bacon and is going to try and explain which ones are more or less important. Now, that's the function of the art historian. Deleuze is not an art historian. Deleuze is trying to construct a kind of philosophical diagram of Bacon's works, and as a result, he's going to pick and choose the influences that are important to Bacon. All right. Now, the central aspect of Bacon's diagram is its exploration of what Deleuze calls the figural, which is a term that he takes from Lyotard. The figural is an attack on the cohesion of the human figure, but more importantly, it's an attack on the Western tradition of organic representation. Deleuze argues that historically, the destruction of classical organic representation has taken one of either two paths, one towards what he calls a purely optical space, or another towards a violent manual space. In the first line, this is the path towards a purely optical space, the contour described by a line that's the basic component of figuration, so a figure is described by a line that draws the contour of the figure, the outline of the figure. So within a purely optical space, this line is submerged by the, Deleuze says, purely optical play of light and shadows, in which the tactile elements of the hand are annulled, and which produces the form through an inner relationship that is specifically optical. So, in other words, the figure is produced through the relationships between light and dark, and no longer by the line. Yeah? So this is going to be there are important moments in the history of art where this happens. Yeah, this, you can see the history of art, especially of painting, as being a long debate between line and colour. Yeah, that at certain points line dominates, at other points colour dominates, right? And there's this kind of debate that goes between them. But the classical way of understanding representation was through prioritizing the line, as Aristotle. So the line is the most important. The line gives you the essence of the thing, and the color comes afterwards and just kind of colors in the object, if you like. Color is not part of the essence of the object. The essence of the object is found in its form, and the form is given by the line. Yeah? And of course, this idea is rediscovered in the Renaissance, and again, the line is the dominant element in the compositional process during the Renaissance, where you have a line usually carved onto or drawn onto a white ground, and the colours are added. The whole question about the colours is one I'm going to get to. Then you have Venetian Renaissance painting, where all of a sudden everything changes, and you no longer have the form described by a line. You have the form emerging from the background, from the ground, which is no longer white, but which is made of dark browns and reds, which is a tonal underpainting, which makes the forms, and then colours are applied over the top of this. So it's no longer the line which is making the form, but it is colours which are making the form. And this is accompanied by a lot of other very radical changes, particularly the emergence of the visibility of the hand. So this is why Venetian painting often looks quite modern to us, because it has gesturality. It has, you can see the brush stroke. Yeah? In fact, in some of the late works of Titian, he's using his fingers. He's just about blind. He's using his fingers directly in the paint. So it's very tactile. So this is a very brief kind of description of the way in which an optical space, a space which is determined, let's say, by relationships of light and dark, or even by relationships of colours, dissolves the outline as, let's say, the fundamental rule of figuration in the Western tradition. So the optical pole utilizes manual techniques of the hand, to create the appearance of depth, contour, and relief, and so forth and so on. But the hand creates optical effects and is itself submerged by these optical effects. So we don't really see the hand as such. We see the form emerge through optical relation. Examples, at least the example that Deleuze discusses the most in the Francis Bacon book, are the Byzantium mosaics, or geometrical abstraction. Byzantium mosaics are precisely going to give form through relationships of colour and relationships of light and dark. And the process of light is going to be especially important. So light reflects off the mosaics and gives a kind of shimmering optical effect that produces the form. It's not the line which is going to produce the form. And this is also historically important, because Venetian painting is going to emerge, at least in part, on the condition of its awareness of Byzantium mosaics, because of its relationship to Constantinople. Venice is one of the most important places in Italy which has Byzantium mosaics, so particularly in the cathedral, the St. Mark's Cathedral. For those of you who have been to Venice and gone into the big church, you'll know it's completely filled with these mosaics, right? Now, that predates the emergence of Venetian Renaissance painting, and that's considered as being an important influence on this dramatic change that emerges in Venice around 1500 in terms of painting. The other example that Deleuze discusses a lot in regards to this optical space is geometrical abstraction from the modernist tradition. Which is about, there is no longer a form, there is only relations optical relations between light and dark parts or coloured parts. At the other pole, there is the free action of the hand creating a manual space that subordinates the eye. So it's the same idea. The line, as the fundamental element of figuration, is destroyed or subordinated or dissolved, not this time by purely optical relations, but now by a kind of pure a pure manual action, yeah? By a kind of a scrambling of the line. And the examples of this pure manual space are the Gothic line and abstract expressionism. So if we think of the Gothic line, this curving, interlacing line, it's abstract because it's not describing a form. So it's like the line has kind of, you know, gone beyond its figurative function, and it no longer describes a form, but just simply describes an abstract shape or pattern. Yeah? And if we think of abstract expressionism and Jackson Pollock, then we have again this manual, the hand, the drip, the movement, yeah, that is a kind of a line. This drip, it's a kind of a line, but it's totally abstract. It's not forming a figure. It can't form a figure. It actually is the negation, if you like, or the impossibility of any figure forming. Now, Bacon's paintings are clearly not one or the other. They're clearly not purely optical spaces, nor are they purely manual activity. Although elements of both appear in the flat coloured grounds, which is typical of all the work, and the random gestural marks, which are also constantly there in the work, these accidents that the work starts from. So there are elements of both aspects within Bacon's work, but Bacon's work, and this is part of its value for Deleuze, explores what he calls a third way that moves in between these two poles. The third way breaks with the figuration of organic representation to produce a figure, a production whose condition of possibility is the heterochronic assemblage of Bacon's diagram, his own recapitulation of the history of painting. So this is what Deleuze likes very much about Bacon's paintings. They are an attack on the figure, on the figuration, on the body, on the human body. You just have to look at a few of Bacon's works to see it. Yeah? This kind of mangled bodies, these kinds of stretched bodies, these kinds of wounded bodies. They're going to be what Deleuze is going to call a body without organs. They are no longer, he says, a head in the portraits. It's just meat. Yeah? It's just a kind of mushed up meat. So you can see it in the works. There's so many carcasses. Bacon is very interested in butcher's shops and so forth and so on. And it's this element which appeals to Deleuze because it's not abstraction either of a geometrical sort or of an abstract expressionist sort. Neither is it simply a pure optical space, nor is it a pure manual space. It's going to combine these elements together. And the way it's going to combine them is by taking bits of historical diagrams and mixing them together in a new way. And the first element which forms this recapitulation of our history is Bacon's reinvention of the Egyptian assemblage. Now, Deleuze follows Riegel in defining Egyptian art according to the space of the bas-relief, in which form and ground appear on the same plane, both separated and united by a contour operating as their common limit. So if we think of Egyptian relief sculpture, so not fully round sculpture, but sculpture that's made on a surface, we have the figure that is defined by a contour, and this contour, there is no space in these works, there is no background, yeah? There is just a flat background and a figure, which is defined by the contour. The contour is therefore the, let's say, the limit, the shared limit between the background field, flat field, and the figure that appears on it, we could say. Yeah? So Bacon is going to take this contour that defines a form and a ground, yeah, but without space. This is something that Bacon is going to take in the way that he composes his paintings of these very flat coloured planes at the back. Then there is a kind of a, he calls it an armature, Deleuze calls it an armature, a kind of a frame or maybe an oval, a sort of a space which is separated from the flat background, and within that space a form, a figure is going to appear. Basically, Deleuze is going to say that in using this element of the Egyptian diagram, Bacon is able to put into relation forces of the outside, forces of the field, and a body that appears within the contour, yeah, that delimits the space inside, and that it is the relationship between this figure and this outside, a kind of a compression and a dilation, a kind of a rhythmic escape and recomposition, which is going to produce this deformation that appears in the body that is painted. And it is this deformation that is going to give the sensation that we are going to have ourselves when we see this painting. So the contour from the Egyptians is very important, because Bacon is able to take it and use it in order to show the forces or the effect of these forces on the body, the way these forces deform this body. And it is through giving us a sensation of that deformation that we ourselves are going to be deformed, that we ourselves are going to join this body without organs, as Deleuze calls it. Okay, I'll try and go a little bit faster, because we're not getting very far. Okay, I'll try and finish by talking about colour, because the two signs of genius in great painters, Deleuze and Guattari, say, are their use of colour and the care with which they use it to join up planes to create the picture's depth. Of course, not perspective. Perspective is a purely optical way of organizing space, and this is not going to be useful for giving a sensation. That perspective is a kind of a way of striating and controlling space, a way of pre-constituting space. Yeah? So the sensation is going to create its own space. It's going to create the space of its own body. Perspective already gives us space. Perspective is a system which pre-exists any given object that exists within it. And this is going to be a kind of limitation and prevention for a sensation to emerge. So in this regard, Bacon's major art historical reference is Cézanne. Cézanne's diagram employs just this kind of colorism, that is, coloured planes. So Cézanne's work, especially the later work, is known for actually precisely not using perspective, because, in fact, a careful analysis of the painting shows, well, not even a careful analysis, you can look at one of these tables with the still life on it and you can see immediately it's not composed according to perspective. The perspective is not correct. Yeah? That instead, what Cézanne does, and this is what Bacon is going to take from him, and this is what Deleuze is so interested in, is he basically composes the form through the juxtaposition of different planes of colour, specifically hot and cold colour. So if you look at Cézanne's paintings, like specifically the later paintings, you see that they are composed, doesn't matter if they're a still life, a portrait, or a landscape, they are composed of these little kind of blocks of colour, these little sort of patches. And the patches usually juxtapose what Deleuze calls hot and cold planes. And Cézanne, they're usually red and blue. Yeah, sometimes yellow and blue or green. And so these hot and cold planes of colour, small planes of colour, are used by Cézanne to construct the form. Yeah? It's not constructed through drawing and it's not constructed through perspective. Yeah? So it is the colour which is going to make the form, not the line. And this is what Cézanne brings that Bacon takes up. In actual fact, Deleuze sees in these hot and cold planes a kind of Goethean system of colour, which is where Deleuze himself takes his own theory of colour from Goethe's Farbenlehre, where Goethe produces an alternative theory of colour to Newton. So Goethe says that colour, it's not about the prism, it's not about the spectrum. It's all about hot and cold colour, that all colours are produced from a difference between yellow and blue. So any colour can be understood as being a kind of differential relation. Deleuze is going to call colour actually a type of differential calculus, that any colour is a differential relation between hot and cold, between yellow and blue. That comes directly from the Farbenlehre. Deleuze quotes that in various places. And what's important about that is that he's going to say that it means that all, instead of tone, what is important is value. This also comes from the Renaissance. It means that, okay, colour makes the form. That's important, right? Not drawing, not the line. Okay. But there are different ways that colour can make a form. The traditional way, and this is also the classical way, is that you add black and white to a given colour, and that produces the modelling of the shape. Now, it's also from Aristotle. Aristotle says, when you look at an object, you draw a line down the part of the object which is closest to you, yeah? And that is the natural colour of the object, and then basically everything else is... It's not closest to me. Anyway, you draw a line at a certain point. That's the essential colour, and you add white or black to mould the shape of the object according to whether it's reflecting of light or in the shade. Yeah? So basically, object has one colour and you just add white or black in order to get the modulation or the moulding of the object. Now that was actually used in a very practical way in the Renaissance, where they actually, that's what they did. There were usually three. There was the natural colour of the object, which was really a natural colour because it's made from a pigment that comes from a natural material. And then you add white and black in three different amounts, and then you just use, those are what you use to describe the object. So you have the natural colour of the object, and you have three lighter shades and three darker shades, and you blend them all together very carefully, and that gives you a three-dimensional object. Now that's called tonality. Tonality is achieved by adding white and black to a colour. But then you have value, and value is something different. Value is where you mix actual colours. So value is where you mix like a blue and a yellow to make green, or you use mix the green with more yellow to make a lighter green, or you mix a blue with a red to make a darker blue, and so forth and so on. So at this point, you have a differential theory of colour because the colour is produced by mixing together the colour with other colours, not mixing together the colour with black and white. The problem with black and white is that for Deleuze it's like a code. Yeah? It's like there's only a certain number of options. But with colour, infinity is opened up, because as soon as you're mixing actual colours, there is no end to the amount of different possibilities that you have. In fact, this is precisely what Goethe said. that with the mixing of colors, you open up infinity. Now, the importance of this is that with the mixing of colors, that is the use of value to describe the forms, you are able to produce what Deleuze calls an analog expression rather than a digital expression. So the problem when you are, let's say, showing a figure in a painting is, okay, what is the means of representation? If the means of representation is tone or tonality, then you effectively have a kind of code which limits, yeah, the way in which the representation can actually express what it is showing. Yeah? That what it is showing only has a certain number of possible ways of being shown. So anyway, that's what we already understand by digital, right? So, you know, when anything is translated into a digital medium, it's being translated into zeros and ones. So the language, if you like, the zeros and ones, that remains the same for whatever it is that's being translated into it, yeah, and doesn't change. So it's a little bit like that with the paint, with the colours, like white and black. That's it. You want to get shade, you add black. You want to get light, you add white. Yeah? So it's a limitation. It means it's a digital form of expression. Now, with the colours, you have an infinite possible range. It's exactly the same as with... I don't imagine any of you would ever remember the day when we listened to records, but records are an analog technology. It means that there is no limit to the frequency range that can be replayed by a record, whereas CDs have a limited frequency range. There is only a certain number of frequencies, or there is a certain range of frequencies.
2000 hertz to 80 hertz.
Thank you very much. That can be reproduced on a CD, and I think an MP3, it's even narrower, yeah, much narrower. So basically, the record can contain much more information, an infinite range of information, than a CD or an MP3, which is even smaller. So it's exactly the same idea in relationship to painting, that for Deleuze, the system using values as the way of mixing the colour is a way that is analogue, because it simply gives the possibility for any force that is to be rendered visible in painting, that it can be done by mixing colour and using colour. But as soon as you use tone, you use a kind of a digital code, and that immediately limits the range of possibility for the expression of forces. Now, Deleuze is going to argue that Cézanne was able to produce analog expressions of the forces of nature because by using the system of the juxtaposition of differential equation, if you like, of hot and cold planes of colour, Cézanne was able to produce in the painting the same sensation of forces, the same forces that produced the mountain, yeah, or that produced the apple. It's the same forces that produces the apple and produces the painting of the apple. It's just that in the mountain, the material is geological and earth and blah, 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 and much, much bigger. And in the painting, the material is paint, yeah, and much smaller, paint and colour. But that's the point of analogical expression, is that Cézanne is able to capture these forces, is able to render these forces visible in the painting. The painting is an analogue of nature, of the mountain, of the apple, yeah, of the person. The same forces that make the mountain make the painting. It's just different material. Yeah? Now, it's the technique which enables Cézanne to do that. It's technical. Yeah? It's about the use of colour, the way that colour is used to modulate the form, and the system of colour that is being used. So in other words, value rather than tone. Yeah? So Bacon is going to stop off at Cézanne. He's going to take this form of analogical expression through value, and he's going to use that in order to explore the human body and the portrait. Now, although Cézanne did do portraits earlier on and throughout his life, he was primarily concerned with landscapes and still lives. So at this point, Deleuze is going to say that's the limit of Cézanne's usefulness for Bacon. Bacon's going to look at a different problem. He's not interested in landscapes. He's not interested in still lifes. He's interested in portraits. He's interested in figures. So at this point, he's going to have to turn to post-impressionism, particularly Gauguin and Van Gogh, in order to draw from them, from their diagram, something else that he needs. Very briefly, what he takes from Gauguin is going to be a kind of, it's known as cloisonism. Cloisonism, I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly. It's a technical term that describes a form of enameling, an artistic form of enameling, which is that a piece of wire is laid on to a piece of metal, and then enamel is placed within that piece of wire. It's melted, and that gives a very, very hard, flat plane of colour. And this technique was used from a very long time ago to produce very elaborate and beautiful objects. And Gauguin kind of re-employs this technique within painting. So in other words, there is a kind of a sense of a line in Gauguin, but this is a line only in the sense that it contains flat planes of colour, rather than a sense in which it might describe a figure. I mean, we're limited now by not being able to look at actual paintings, but there are some paintings by Gauguin, especially from, let's say, the South Pacific period, so from about 1889 onwards, I think, which is the first trip to Tahiti, he begins to paint in this way. And this is the element that Bacon takes from him, and from Van Gogh, he takes a modulation of the background. Now, this is one of the elements which is hardest to see, certainly, in the reproductions, but Deleuze is going to say that the flat planes of colour that Bacon used are not totally uniform. In other words, they're not so much related, say, to Barnett Newman and the other, let's say, colour field painters in the American tradition, which use a very, very flat plane of colour, but are much more related to Van Gogh, who is going to introduce this kind of textured, swirling, flat background behind some of his self-portraits and various other paintings as well. So this is the element that he takes from these two post-impressionist painters. So the question then is, this is a very, very brief and fast move through the Francis Bacon book, only concentrating on one major element, which is this diagrammatic element, because it relates to what we've already been talking about, art history. But the question remains, what then are we to do with this if we are wanting to go, let's say, beyond Francis Bacon and try to think about other forms of art, and most particularly to think about art after the conceptual turn, so post-conceptual art, art where, let's say, the concept is the or one of the most important organising elements. And on the one hand, I think it's possible to generalise many of the elements that Deleuze is talking about in the Bacon book. That is, despite the very technical nature and very, let's say, close reading of Bacon's paintings that Deleuze offers in the book, it is possible to see certain ways in which it could be extended to discuss other artists apart from Bacon. Perhaps a better question, though, is to ask, could it be extended beyond painting? Or maybe another way of asking that would be, could this theory of painting that we find in the Bacon book be extended beyond simply, let's say, oil on canvas, paint on canvas, this more traditional understanding of painting? So can this theory of painting be extended into a theory of art that might encompass performance art or let's say as it's known, expanded practice or installation art, video art, etc., etc., etc. Video art, I think, we can keep to one side because it's maybe more useful to think about video art in relationship to the work on cinema, where there are some suggestions about how video might appear within the theory of cinema that Deleuze suggests. But let's say installation, performance, and conceptual type work. So these, I think, would be the three main innovations that emerge in the 60s and that constitute, you know, a vast majority of contemporary practice today. So to what extent is this theory of painting, of a painter, of colour? Again, colour is one of those things that with the move to contemporary practice becomes less and less important. So artists today, unless they're painters, are not usually concerned with colour as a fundamental element of their practice. Whereas previous to the 60s, colour, if you were a painter, and you were either a painter or a sculptor, or maybe a photographer, then colour was clearly central to what you were doing. So can, let's say, a philosophical theory of art or of sensation that is grounded on the theory of colour be used to discuss, you know, a contemporary work which maybe doesn't exist in the gallery, which exists only in a kind of series of relationships established by the artist with various people and institutions in the community? Can this really work? I think, you know, it's possible to go either way. I think it's possible to extend the theory of painting to a more generalized theory of art. People are trying to do that. The French philosopher who was a student of Deleuze's, I've mentioned him before, Eric Hayez, published two very big books in the last 2 years about the history of modernism that tries to argue and extend this idea of painting into something that can be applied to contemporary practice. On the other hand, maybe it can't, which I think is also a very interesting possibility, because one of the things that contemporary art also assumes is that art is no longer simply aesthetics in the traditional philosophical sense of the word, that art is no longer simply about sensation, art is no longer simply about feeling, that art is about concepts, art is about politics, art is about ideas, and so forth and so on. So, in actual fact, according to this way of understanding art, it's perfectly okay to reject Deleuze's work about art, Deleuze's work about aesthetics, to say that's not what we're interested in as contemporary artists. We're not interested in colour, we're not interested even perhaps in sensation. We're interested in something else, and for that reason, we can take anything we want. We don't have to just be interested in writing about art or writing about aesthetics. We can also be interested in the work on politics or the work on philosophy. All right, so I kind of finish with those questions, because I think these are the questions that we end with if we move through a trajectory within Deleuze about aesthetics, about art. I think, in my opinion anyway, inevitably end up at this point where you have to make a decision about whether to try and apply Deleuze in a way which is consistent with his own aesthetics. This requires, obviously, either rejecting a great deal of contemporary art, or being very inventive with Deleuze's own categories in order to find a way in which to apply them. Those are the two possibilities, I think, that you get. And these are the two possibilities which, in my opinion, also have not really been addressed very successfully by people following on from Deleuze. So that is kind of now the end of the specifically Deleuzean trajectory, because when we come back in January, there's going to be two lectures, one on Alain Badiou and one on Jacques Rancière, which I will try and contrast a little bit their ideas with Deleuze's and try and explore perhaps this question of a philosophy of contemporary art a little bit through their work as a way of sort of maybe trying to give us some ideas or some contrasts or some alternatives to the Deleuzean trajectory. So I hope everyone has a good Christmas and New Year, and we'll see you back on January the 9th, I think it is. Okay.